tax the rich, feed the poor, tell there are no rich no more. I love to choose the world, but I don't know what to do. So I'll leave it up to you. I'll leave it up to you. Love to change that old world. One way we could change the world pretty dramatically is to pull the tax system out by its roots. And of course, that usually is the topic and subject that this two-hour slot revolves around anyway. So we're going to dig real deep into it here on the 10th of April, a week before the week or so, I guess, before the real April Fool's Day. And always everybody's favorite time of the year, right? Roger Sales here with you on the Republic Broadcasting Network, filling in for the late, filling in on a kind of a regular basis on the late Ralph Winterout. And I know a lot of you guys miss him, and I'm sure the community misses him. And Ralph did a lot of good work for a lot of years, and I'm pretty honored and privileged to step in behind him and commandeer this slot for all of the listeners that he's built up over all these years, all the goodwill, all the credibility, and all the things that go along with what Ralph did. So tonight we're going to go back into some information that Ralph didn't even know. And very few people in the world know. If you've heard this before, if you've been exposed to it already, you've got a little bit of a head start on some of the others that haven't. But what we're going to do is go back to the ancient origins of the tax system this evening and explain it to you and explain its origins and how it developed and where the gotchas are and how they brought it over here and imposed it on us, and again where the gotchas are and all that things. Now let me clarify something. This is not my research. This is my teacher's research, and because one of them is no longer with us, the legal guy that was the progenitor of all this, the spearhead, the driving force behind all of this, and his sidekick for many years, who's still with us and is a good friend of mine, and actually I just we don't speak very often, unfortunately, but I did speak with him yesterday, Glenn Ambort, and told him that we were going to be going over this tonight. And it's those two guys that put all this together, and what I'm going to do is tell you where it came from and give you some background, and then we're going to get into the specifics of it. It's quite interesting, actually. This is the result of more than 70 years of total research in two men's lives. You know, my teachers did spend 15 and a half years in federal prison. The feds couldn't stand them on the street with this information. They didn't even have this back then. They didn't know they had all this stuff we're going to talk about tonight. But I've always felt that because here's what happened with them originally. John W. Benson had been researching this. He'd been studying law since he was since he was very young. He was just somebody that loved the law and liked to study it, and he didn't go to law school. He went back to the old books and the kind of stuff they don't teach in law school anymore, and some of these topics and subjects they haven't taught in our law schools for probably 100 years, actually. I did find a very nice little nugget of information that tells me that they've been in control of the curriculums for law schools all the way back to 1933, when they, on the eve of the annual convention of the American Association of Colleges and Law Schools. I found this in a Lewis T. McFadden speech on the House floor. And he was referring to this, and I went and researched it because it was very provocative for me. Titillating, maybe, is the word. They were in such control that in 1933, they took the annual convention of the American Association of Colleges and Law Schools, and they moved it to New Year's Eve in Chicago so that one guy could give a speech called Jurisprudence and the New Deal. Okay? And he was from the Department of Agriculture, as Mr. McFadden
referred to him, the little Jew. His name was Jacob Frank. And they moved that convention in 1933 to Chicago on New Year's Eve so this guy could give a keynote speech on jurisprudence and the New Deal and what they were doing. So they've been in control of them where they could do that for that organization that oversees all the American colleges and law schools. You can bet they were controlling the curriculum and some of these things. And as you can see, the repercussions in our community with questions like, what's the legal concept behind the meaning of the word person? I just heard it again last night in an interview. Oh, it's a corporation. No, person's a corporation. You don't want to be one of those. Well, it's partially right. A person can be a corporation, but it can also be a trust. It can be an individual, one of us. It can be a partnership. It can be a number of different things. So it's not just a corporation, and that's what our entire legal community, for the 30 years I've been in it, wants to pigeonhole everybody into one definition to that one word, and it's just flat incorrect. Okay, so that's the kind of things that they're not teaching in law schools anymore, is that type of information, or at least very sporadically and not on a regular basis. So anyway, that's this information was put together, and John and met Glenn at a traffic seminar in Bullhead City, Arizona. A friend of one of John's students was an airline pilot, gotten him a ticket and flown him down to this traffic deal, and he met Glenn, who was becoming interested in that at that time. And that's how they met. And if it wouldn't have been for that incident, when John passed away, all this information would have probably been stacked in a closet in his apartment and gotten thrown away. But Glenn is a real mover and a shaker, and he said, I see a business opportunity here, because what John had found in the regulations, some of you will be familiar with this term, a revocation of election. Well, that was John's research, and he had found in the Internal Revenue Code regulation, CFR, where if you've been filing under the wrong status, you could correct your status, and you could file 3 years returns, 1040 NRs. Do not file one of those, by the way. A 1040 NR, a non-resident alien return, and they'd give you 3 years of taxes that you'd paid in back. And so they said, well, there's a business opportunity here. So that's what they were doing, was teaching people this, and then they'd charge you for a seminar, and then they'd get a percentage of whatever you got back from the IRS. And it worked for the first few people that did it. It worked like a snap. Some folks got some pretty large checks back. And then the IRS figured out what was going on and slammed the door. By the time I went in and filed mine, I got $500 frivolous filing penalties for each one of mine. Now that's a $5,000 frivolous filing penalty that they like to throw around. They had sent all the class materials and a whole outline of what they were teaching to the IRS Service Center in Philadelphia, is the one that handles non-resident alien returns. And they said, we're going to be going around the country teaching this. And if any of your agents would like to attend our seminar, if they'll show us their ID, we'll not only let them in for free, but we'll give them free class materials. And the IRS wrote them back and said, well, thank you very much. We'll turn this over to the education department. Well, directly, the education department must have gotten it, because they showed up at their offices with drawn Glocks and held them on the floor with the Glocks on their head for about 8 hours. Just through a fortuitous events that Glenn was out of the office, called back in, sensed what was going on, ran to the bank and cleaned out the bank account before the IRS could, so they still had funds to operate and continued to fight. But it was because they knew they were under this feudal system and the key to the tax system that I believe they came after them. They didn't charge them with anything to do with any of this stuff. It was all extemporaneous charges. They had 90 charges against Glenn. When the feds come at you and they're going to throw 90 charges at you, something's going to stick. Okay. So it was in that incident that they ended up spending 9.5 years for Glenn and 6 years for John. Along the way, Glenn was in a separate facility, and he wanted to get into a ministerial program. He's quite spiritual. And this is where the fat, fickle finger of fate, bureaucratic fat, fickle finger fate, kicked in. And the ministerial program had a branch, one of the facilities it was taught in was the facility John was in Petersburg, Virginia. And so they got to spend several years there together. They had all this information that we're going to cover tonight, but they didn't have it solidified and down. And it was in that experience of this bureaucrat sending Glenn, thank you, Lord, sending Glenn to the same facility where they could spend 4 or 5 hours an afternoon together and hammer all this out. And the book that we're going to at least mention tonight, the book that it contains all this information, Sam put the link up on our space there on the Republic Broadcasting website on the Radio Ranch space. My book is there linked, and so is this book, and the title of it is Taxation Without Representation, The Truth About Taxes in Plain English. Now, where did it come from? Where did this information come from? In all of John's study, he had run across a case from 1855, still good law today, actually. If you want to go look it up, you can go look it up. The style of the case is Murray's Lessee v. Hoboken Land and Improvement Company. Murray's Lessee v. Hoboken Land and Improvement Company. I'm not sure of the site, but that's the style of the case. And in that case, it was a jeopardy assessment case, which means that they're going to come grab something because they think you might get out of the country with it and beat them out of it. Okay, 1855, we didn't have an income tax back then. It was about a guy who was a tax collector at the port of New York and had embezzled incredible amounts of money for that day. And he had gone and bought land with it. And then the land had been sold to this Hoboken Land and Improvement, and that's where the government came in and did this jeopardy assessment and seized this. And there's several cases on jeopardy assessments throughout the repertoire of cases dealing with tax. I know one in the last century's U.S. versus Bull. That's another one that deals with the same topic. But in this Murray's Lessee, what they were saying was, keep in mind the time frame here, 1855. And they were saying in the case, they said, well, we don't have anything to do with due process of tax law in the Constitution, so we'll just have to defer back to the country that we came from and England and their processes. And in the footnotes to that case, there were several authors who had written books dealing with, in England, the Treasury is called the Exchequer. And we're dealing with the tax system and the processes of the Exchequer. One of them, two, I remember two of the names. One is Chitty, like with a C-H-I-T-T-Y, not Chitty. And the other is Price. And so this was way before the internet, back in the early 90s. And John and Glenn went to the only resource that they had available to try and find those types of books, and that is the Interlibrary Loan Service. And so you can get on there. I think that's still active and probably better connected. Probably most of these books are available on the internet now. But you could go and it'll search all the libraries and what titles they had. And so they took, there was about five authors, I think, but Chitty and Price are the two I remember. And they put all the authors and the titles in the search, their interlibrary search, and they could only come up with two of these books in the entire United States. One was at the Library of Congress, and the other, interestingly enough, was at Texas A&M University. So the question then becomes, how do you expect anybody in our country to have any idea of the system that is being imposed on them when it comes from England and there's only two books in the entire country covering the process? And so they diligently got those books, and they got as many of the others as they could eventually, and digested them. And then they got into this little confab with the feds and got sent up the river. And so they had all the information, but they didn't have the communication and stuff. And then the fat finger of fate from the bureaucrat stuck them together in the same facility where John could go out. I mean, you said they had a athletic field out there, football or soccer or something, and they could go out on one corner of that every afternoon under a big shade tree and sit there and spend a number of hours. And they one of the reasons I'm so familiar with it is they would hand write all this stuff out and send it to me, and I would type it up and send it back to them until Glenn was adept enough to scrounge a typewriter, and then that stopped. But so I was even involved in the early stages of this and the typing of it. So what happens here is we've got a system, and it's funny, I did an interview Friday with Sarah Westall on our regular kind of stuff, status stuff, and I was telling her about this because I think this information interests a lot of people, needs to be out there, okay? And I was telling her about this, and I said, well, Sarah, when do you think the tax system started? That's a good question. And she said, didn't it start around the time Federal Reserve started? And I went, no, not really. It started, as we're going to chronicle it, it was even before that, but I don't know the history before that, of 1285 is when our current system started. And the history of it is fascinating, and it's incredibly interesting, okay? And that's what we're going to cover tonight. I'm kind of keeping an eye on the start of it here because we're pretty close to a break. Sam's going to throw something at us and some music and stuff here in a second. It's interesting to note that if you go back and study this and think about it, the reason that we're under the yoke of this tax system that's so burdensome and antiquated, those were Woodrow Wilson's words to describe it, as they were going to impose it on China back 100-some-odd years ago, is, and he denied the bankers had come to him. You can actually, I should go into this because you can go look this up. Put in a search engine, Woodrow Wilson, and then repudiation of dollar diplomacy. Repudiation of dollar diplomacy. Found this first document I ever found when I woke up and started researching this before the internet had all this stuff, and I found it in the Cobb County Library there in Cobb County, Georgia, where I was living. And in this time frame, and what it is, it'll tell you there if you want to go look it up. It's pretty short to read. It's a good read. This is the blueprint, okay? And Wilson said, I had a consortium of bankers. It was like a gaggle of geese, I guess. A consortium of bankers had come to him and asking him to underwrite this loan that they were being requested to make to China. They were going to make a $100 million loan to China and help China build its railroad system. And they wanted Woodrow Wilson to co-sign on it, basically to get the military for the muscle to collect the taxes. And Wilson declined. And so in that legal answer there, repudiation of dollar diplomacy, he goes over the reasons that he declined to underwrite the loan. And he talks about the going to the political heart of this once great country. And he talks about the tax system, which he describes in those adjectives that I just used. I think they're excellent. Burdensome and antiquated. Burdensome and antiquated. Is that a perfect description for the IRS code? Burdensome and antiquated, and enforced by foreign agents. So there's your blueprint that the IRS is not a government agency, okay? And interestingly enough, the bad guys went ahead and made this loan to China. China never paid a penny back on it, and the Brit bondholders got paid when they got Hong Kong and gave it back to the Chinese. That was part of the stipulations on that handing over that territory back to them. But they hate Americans, the Chinese do, and they have never paid and probably will never pay a penny. There's 20,000 of these bondholders from that bond issue in the United States. And I heard the gal that's the head of the bond organization in the United States, I saw her twice on Epic News talking about this. Trump knew about this because she said she'd met with him. Okay. So the amount that they owe us on the 20,000 bondholders that are American is $1.7 trillion, okay? Trump could have gone in, bought those for pennies on the dollar, and fed back China its debt every month with its own defaulted bonds. So you might want to go look that up. Here's the music, first break. Be back on the other side, and we'll get started.
Consider this. Dead people see only what they want to see. And frankly, most of us are still dead. Let me give you the lessons of gold and five easy lessons. Number one, don't buy it because you need to make money. You buy gold because you need to protect the money you already have. Don't ever look at the price as a barrier. Look at it as an incentive. Number three, don't buy its paper pretenders. We talked about that a lot. Buy gold. Buy the real thing in the form of coins and bullion. Fourth, don't fall prey to glitzy television or Facebook ads. Do your due diligence instead. And that's what I try to provide you with and have for 26 and a half years on the air and 30 years in this profession. Fifth, don't allow naysayers to divert your interest. Allow yourself the right to protect your interests as you see fit. Jeff Bennett here. One of the ways you can do that is to contact Kettle Moraine Limited. Contact me by calling or texting me at 602-799-8214. 602-799-8214. You can also email me at kettlemoraineltd@cox.net. Let me help you protect your wealth and your family today. Once again, call or text us at 602-799-8214 or visit our website, sierramadreprecious metals.com. Be glad to help you out. Be glad to answer your questions. That's what we're here for. No pressure, just good, hard, common sense. The decision then becomes up to you.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
All right, Sam. Sam asked me to give him 5 seconds there. So Roger Sales back with you in the after the first break here. We're talking about the origins of the tax system. And before we launch off into this, I was just going to give you some background there in the first part. The tax system, interestingly enough, was a setup and was a repercussion of us lying. And in the early days, you know, England, I'm pretty sure I don't have to tell any of you that England's an island, okay? And so in the northern hemisphere and up in the interesting longitudes there to where it might not be able to provide all the things that the English people would like because of the climate. They're real good with wool. They're mighty good with oats and stuff like that, but there's a lot of things. Tin, they were a big tin producer, obviously. But there's a lot of things that they need, and so that necessitates trade. You know, that's one of the differences of us and other animals is we're the only animal that trades, okay? I have a couple other differences, too, but that's an important one. Trade is integral, and, of course, these are the merchants of the earth we're dealing with. And so you know the merchants of the earth are going to be all over any trade that takes place, which is what's been going on historically, obviously. And it's one of the reasons they're so adept at the merchant law is because they've been using it for so many thousands of years, and they understand its little nuances and how they can manipulate it and turn things around, which they do a lot. Okay, especially in our enslavement. So in those days, traders used what's called triangulation. They'd go from one place. I mean, you've seen this with the slaves. They'd go down to Jamaica and get rum. They'd come up and trade it for something else, and then they'd take the whatever else, and they'd go trade it for black slaves, and then they'd take the slaves and trade it for molasses, and they'd take it up and make rum. And so it's a constant triangle. And England was one of the triangles, one of the stops in the triangle, except that because England had the common law, and then if there was a dispute, any of the disputes had to go to a common law type court, the jury, and, you know, very formal proceeding. And in the common law, the law is the process. In the law of the city, the outcome is the object. And in common law, the process is the object. And if you follow the process, then you'll get the correct outcome. That's two of the big differences in those two bodies of law. But in those days, when the Jewish merchants primarily would go to court, and the Anglo-Saxons would get their buddies to come in and lie for them, and the Jewish traders would get gypped out of their profit, and so they quit coming back to England. Well, when they quit coming back to England, England wasn't in the triangle anymore, and it not only was not getting the things that it needed, it was not able to off the things that it had abundance of, and it caused a huge problem in England. Okay, so much so that they passed legislation in 1285. The origins of this, although the origins of the document and the instrument go farther back to, as one English guy said at the time, I remember John telling us this, this comes from time out of mind. So this instrument that we're going to talk about, a Jewish shetar, is a time out of mind instrument, but this is how it was incorporated and molded in to the English common law. Now keep in mind here, we got two different English common laws. Okay, we've got the Anglo-Saxon common law, which was before 1066, and we've got the English common law after 1066 and the conquest of William the Conqueror, bringing in the European common law, which included feudalism, and bringing it in and overlaying it over the Anglo-Saxon common law. So there's your two differentials in the English common law. And here we're into the William the Conqueror segment, because that was 1066. This is 1285. Okay, and the legislation was called the Statute de Mercantoribus, the Statute de Mercantoribus, or the Statute of the Merchants. And it was totally designed to try and remedy this problem that and protect the merchants that were bringing trade to the island, to take things that they had an abundance of and to bring them things that they really wanted or needed for their day-to-day existence. Okay, and so the Statute de Mercantoribus set up this system, and what it did was it designated a number of key towns, what you're called statute towns, okay? Those are the trading centers, and they were set up under this piece of legislation, and those obviously were Liverpool, Manchester, Southampton, probably London, and I'm sure there were other ones. Those are the only the port cities that I know, and those were big port cities back then, especially Liverpool. So you can just know that those were part of the Statute de Mercantoribus. What the legislation did was, in the event of a dispute between merchants, it put all the onus of settling the dispute and the power to oversee it into the mayor of whatever that statute town was. So he became the mayor of the staple. Okay, those are called staple towns, like staples that you need. Okay, statute staples, the instrument. Okay, but they made the mayor of the town, let's say Liverpool, he was the mayor of the staple. Okay, and so what his job was, if there was any disagreement or any kind of a situation where they needed to go to him, is, well, we'll stop there with the mayor of the staple, and we're going to have a little breaky poo, and we're going to be back on the other side and continue our little story.
The truth. You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Real news, real talk, real people. Because you can handle the truth.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Extendivite has proven time and again it really works. Here's a testimonial from Amazon.com. I am only 40, but I have put my body through hell working in manufacturing for 20 years. I recently started to notice a buzzing feeling along with a stuttering sensation with my heart. I had a full cardio stress done, which I passed. I decided to try Extendivite after getting the jingle stuck in my head. Halfway through the bottle, I really did notice a difference. After getting home from work, I would just sit in a chair for a few hours feeling like crap, and this stuff reduced that feeling along with heart discomfort to almost nothing. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com. That's HEARTDROP.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Thank you, Samuel. Okay, back after the little breaky-poo, and we're talking about the mayor of the staple, the Statute de Mercantoribus from 1285 and the origins of our modern-day tax system. So, but to cure this problem of Anglo-Saxons lying in court to cover their buddies and steal, it brought forth this system, and here almost 1,000 years later, it's been put over our necks. Okay. So the Statute de Mercantoribus set up this system to alleviate these problems and to get trade flowing again back to jolly old England. And the first step was to go in and name certain towns and designate them as staple towns. And the second step was to make the mayor of that town the mayor of the staple. They put him in charge as that personage over any of these disputes. So if there was a dispute where a trader had a dispute with a local merchant, they would take the dispute to the mayor. And the mayor at that point would put it under seal, which we're going to talk about more in a minute, put it under seal in a document called a statute staple. And in that process, it literally made the person that was due and owing of the bill, it made him property, okay? It made him property probably of the mayor of the staple. And anything that came into his hands, whether it was from rents, whether it was from other business deals, whether it was from an inheritance, of no matter what is a good IRS phrase, no matter what source derived, any source derived of anything that came through his hand was seized and turned over to the debtor until the debt was satisfied, and then the statute staple bond that this mayor of the staple had put under seal on this arrangement was lifted, and everything was back, and the debtor got his payment, and the guy had fulfilled his obligations, and then life returned to some sort of normalcy. Okay. Now, the instrument that we're talking about here is called a statute staple bond or contract. All right. And it's also known as a Jewish shetar, S-H-E-T-A-R. And it's also, by the way, known as a 1040 form. So all three of those things are the exact same thing. And if you'd like to get a little more of an in-depth history of this, there's a really pretty darn good, very, very legal written article. I've got it on my website, Sovereign to Serf. Sovereign, T-O, spelled out, surf.com. Over on the right-hand side, you'll see a picture there of me standing in the middle of the world here in Ecuador, which is the only place on land in the world where your GPS reads all zeros. And over on the right-hand side, it says references, and there's a number of really interesting and key references there. You should avail yourself of many of them, if not all of them. But particularly as we're dealing with this subject today, it deals in-depth with this. And it was an article, and it's entitled, I believe the title is How the Jewish Shetar Invaded the English Common Law. And it's about this right here that we're talking about. A lot more detail, a lot more history in there. So if you really want to read about it, you can go over there. It was published in the Georgetown Law Review, pretty prestigious law journal, and back in the 70s, I believe. And the author was a Jewess named Judith Shapiro. And she did a very good job, except somehow she neglected to tell you that a Jewish shetar is a 1040 form. She never did mention that in her little scholarly article. I can't imagine why. But that's a good resource if you want to delve in and read a little bit more about this we're talking about here this evening. So this Jewish shetar is another one of these merchant documents, okay? It comes from the merchant law, the Babylonian merchant code. And I should also plug another reference that's over there right around this same article, which is a book that was published in the 1930s, and John Hopkins University published it, and it's entitled Historical Jurisprudence. Historical Jurisprudence. I don't know if we've mentioned it on the Sunday night program here previously or not, but for those of you who really want to get a good foundation in this, that book, the first 90 pages of that book, is entitled The Babylonian Merchant Code. Okay, and this is the origins. It actually was even the Code of Hammurabi and the Sumerians actually had developed, evidently, the nucleus of it, but it was perfected in Babylon. Babylon, as it says in that book, it says Babylon's great contribution to the world was it reduced everything in the society down to the abstract form of contract. So this is where contract law, and this is merchant law, and the merchants of the earth is are replete in the Bible, and the reference is there. Obviously, the merchants of the earth use merchant law. Okay. So that's what we're dealing with. And as we get a little bit deeper into this, particularly with IRS, for those of you who still are under the mistaken illusion that we're under admiralty law or some type of maritime law, we're under merchant law. Okay. And that's exactly right. And you can prove it by the remedies that are used. All right. So the statute staple Jewish shetar 1040 form is in the Uniform Commercial Code, which we call the Babylonian merchant law today, is in a section of the code called specialty contracts. And there's a number of these contracts that they use against us are over there in that section, specialty contracts. And for this to qualify itself as a Jewish shetar or a statute staple or a 1040, all those are the same, It has to have two things. It has to have two ingredients, if you will. And one of them is it has to be signed under seal. That means under penalty of perjury. And the other one is that it has to have what's called a recognizance. Okay? And that's a fancy word with a root of it being recognize. So there's a recognition clause in your 1040 that you sign under penalties of perjury that recognizes another body of law. It defers to another body of law. And when you sign your 1040, if you're going to ever again, or you do, the recognizance in there is that you will abide by all the terms and conditions of Title 26 Code of Federal Regulations. All right. It's the same way they've got a recognizance in a car loan. When you do any type of a vehicle loan, truck or car or whatever else, there's a recognizance in there too. And the recognizance in that type of loan is the recognizance of your local state statutes and whatever your local state legislature, has put into effect on your payment schedule. In other words, if you miss two payments and it's more than 60 days late, they can come grab your car, all right? They don't grab it under admiralty law, and they don't grab it under maritime law. They grab it under merchant law with things called self-help remedies, lien, levy, garnishment, and seizure. Those are self-help remedies. That is written into the contract, okay? And so we'll get a little bit more in depth. It's super important because it really tells you the body of law we're under. All right. The only remedy in admiralty law is prize. And that means there's no process. I kick your butt and I come grab your stuff because I kicked your butt. That's the only remedy. All right. Well, that's not what's being used. It appears that it is. But they have a certain process. They have to follow it because of the Administrative Procedures Act, which Ralph talked about on here quite a bit, I'm sure, and the fact that they've got certain guidelines and certain rules that they have to follow when they do these things. All right. Those are all merchant law. These are self-help remedies. They're super important to understand, and they're very, very important to what we deal with here. I've come to, over the years, understand that in my own mind that these are the harbingers of tyranny. Because they run this law in on you and get you under it, and the normal people have no idea what's going on, and all of a sudden these authoritative figures come and start grabbing your stuff. You know, they grab your car, they come in and garnish your wages, they clean out your bank account, they just like in Murray's lessee there, they go grab this land and whatever, all this power. It looks like they're unlimited power that they have, but they don't. They've got the power because these remedies have been triggered by whatever process that you've been involved with them, and they come and get to grab your stuff. Now, let me tell you the validity of these. See, all these things have valid uses. It's just that our enemies are able, because of their intricate knowledge of it and their intricate evilness, they can turn these things around and use them and weaponize them against us, all right? But in the car loan example, if you don't pay your car the note in 60 days, and it had to go through a very formal procedure in a common law court, well, you'd go into court and you'd get it on the docket. It'd come around a couple of months later, and then you'd have to go through a jury trial, and the jury would have to go in and deliberate, and they'd have to come back with a verdict. And when they got the verdict and the judgment, they'd have to go register the judgment, and then they could come grab the car. Well, you may be in Tierra del Fuego, okay? So these self-help remedies do have a very, very legitimate and a very beneficial purpose. They're also, by the way, these are the remedies that changed Rome. And changed Rome from the Roman civil law for the first 200 years, the only other time an organized society has had God-given laws in the history of our planet and the first 200 years of our country. And they changed that because the foreign merchants that were coming to Rome as the empire expanded got to see the merchants using this easy way to remedy disputes and contracts. But they had the formal way because they were under a common law system, and over 200 years of the Roman citizens going to the Attorney General of Rome, who's called the Praetor, and they'd come in, hey, we want to get that easy way of remedy. We want that easy remedy. So over 200 years, in the color of law that a Roman citizen was a foreign merchant, the praetor gradually gave in and incorporated the merchant law into the Roman jus civil, J-U-S civil, the law of the civilian, and it became the jus gentium, the law of the foreigner, and this is when the merchant law invaded the Roman common law and gave us what's called Roman civil law. That's the United States code today. That's virtually every code of every country on the world is this melding of these two bodies of law and the civil codes that rule those countries. Code of Justinian, Code of Bismarck, Napoleonic Code, all the Roman civil law, all the same basically. Okay, there's only two types of law. There's nature, nature's God, the law of the land, and then there's the law of the city. And all of these different varieties of law all fit into this law of the city because they're all based on this Babylonian merchant code and these contracts. Okay, and the fact that everything's a contract. So that's a little bit of the basis here. They brought that system in and invaded the English common law, and it straightened out England's problems. Okay, it straightened them out to the point where after a couple of hundred years, and they got a little bit down the road, and they got a king got himself in a bunch of financial trouble named Henry VIII, you know, chasing all these women, Anne Boleyn. He wanted to get divorced. He couldn't get a male heir. He tried to divorce one of them, and he went to the Pope to try and get the divorce decree. The Pope wouldn't give it to him. And so he's trying to fight all these wars and do all these other things. He's strapped like crazy for money and funds. And so he goes over, he says, well, listen, this statute staple thing has worked so well in trade and straightened all that on the island, I'm just going to incorporate it over into the exchequer, and it's going to be the way I collect my taxes. And so that's how it got incorporated over and was the tax mechanism that was applied to the English people, okay, as opposed to just this exclusive trading arrangement. Now, the Treasury in England, as I alluded to earlier, is called the Exchequer. Okay, and the reason it's called the Exchequer is when the king's taxmen would go out in the countryside to start doing their investigation and talk to the people to, quote-unquote, voluntarily declare their tax, they would carry a big checkered tablecloth. And where they'd see a table or they'd set up a table and they'd throw this checkered tablecloth over it, and people started calling it the Exchequer, and that's where it got its name. Okay, so as they incorporated this statute de mercantoribus, statute staple system into their tax collection in England, they had a specific process, and they'd go out and go through the same process, and they'd go out and set up the table, and the people would come in and voluntarily do their taxes, and they would do their inquests and all that stuff. But if you were negligent, and they had to come back, and they did a commission, and there was a building that they went to, and the upper chamber was where they had the tax assessors and the people that would come up with this information. And it was connected to an office underneath it, which is where the assessment rolls and the assessments took place. And so if you had not paid your tax, they would go out and they'd do what the IRS does today. They'd go around, talk to your neighbors and say, boy, old Fred, man, he's driving a Lamborghini. He's got a Ferrari in there, and he's telling us he's not making any money. And what kind of – is he having wild parties? And all the questions that they like to ask, and they come back and they ascertain, well, Fred must have a pretty heck of a good income. So they come back and just start pulling figures out of thin air because you haven't declared, and they don't have any other way to get that information. They do now, obviously, much more sophisticated in our day. But they would bring that information back to the office up there on the top level, and they would come up with a figure, and then they would write that figure on a piece of sheepskin, actually, and they would roll it up because the office on above was connected to the office below through a pipe, kind of like a numismatic pipe that you get at banks, you know, where you drive up and you pull out the little plastic thing and you stick it, whatever you want, your deposit or whatever, and stick it in there, and it sucks it in, and the teller gets it over there. Well, it's kind of like that. They didn't have that numismatic gear back then, obviously, but because gravity would fulfill that, and they would take and roll up whatever they had dealt with on a particular case, and they would shove it down the pipe because the two offices were connected with a pipe, and the name of the office underneath was called the Office of the Pipe. Okay, and that was where the assessment rolls were. So the guys up top would do the assessment, they'd write it down, and they'd shoot it down to the Office of the Pipe, and the Office of the Pipe would register that amount on the assessment rolls. Okay, now here's where the processes really differ. All right, in those days, if you got charged with an amount that you felt was wrong, you could challenge that assessment. And to challenge the assessment, you got to go in front of a common law court and a jury of your peers. And so if there was any kind of a judgment, it came out, they would register it and go do whatever they had to do. But the point being is that you got a common law court trial to alleviate that and try and find out what the true situation was. And you can see already, if you're getting ahead of me, on the system we're in, what they've done with that is they've run you over into a tax court, okay? And they've, as I say, some of the names and the terms here and the process has been changed to protect the guilty, all right? And so what they've done is they've hidden a number of these things, including the remedy, where in the English variety, you would get to go to a common law court and a jury of your peers. In our variety, you've got to petition the tax court. There's music, okay? So you've got to petition the tax court, which has all kinds of pitfalls in it, that we're going to discuss as soon as we get back on the other side of this little break. So I'll see you in just a minute.
Standing 6'4", weighing 245 pounds of crime-fighting, political science-analyzing brawn, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Patrick Slattery.
So, Mike, get off this anti-cicada agenda.
I'm a born-again traditional Christian, and my favorite possessions are right here on my nightstand. That would be the King James Bible and my .357 revolver.
I'd rather be ruled by Chinamen than Jews.
Cool it with the anti-Semitic remarks, right?
Just because you steal an election and terminate the republic doesn't mean you terminate the people in the republic, because we're still here.
I'm not taking the vaccine. Fuck you, Bill Gates.
There was a way forward still on January 6th. What needed to be done is to object to every single state.
The COVID-19 virus was the setup. The vaccine could very well be the bioweapon.
The Patrick and Jeremy Show, Tuesday at 9 Central and Wednesday at 1 Central.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Are you sick of censorship? TLB Talk is the cure. TLB stands for Truth, Liberty, and Balance. We are the newest and most unique social media platform to hit the internet. We were built out of necessity because big tech, big pharma, and big brother are out of control. The only thing bigger than them is when we the people are united. With that vision, TLB Talk was born. Our battlefield is in cyberspace. The battle we're in can be won by clicks of buttons and voting with your wallet. TLB Talk has no hidden agendas, no corporate funding, and we do not sell, trade, or give away any of your information. Our platform runs off of generous donations of members and merchandise profits. So please, check out our site. It's the best around. And be sure to stop by our store. It's loaded with items that'll have you feeling a sense of member pride and victory. Come unite with us today at TLBTalk.com and join the social media revolution.
love to change the world, and we could get rid of the tax system. That'd be a step in the right direction, a giant step. Take a giant step. So we were talking about the tax court aspect of this versus the common law grand jury that are jury that you used to get in the English process. And, of course, they've switched the process around to weaponize it and hide things and, of course, give them a distinct advantage. And this is one of them. It's known, some of you will know this, and I'm sure Ralph talked about it. It's known in the vernacular in our community as a 90-day letter. Because they've gone through the process and they've got you already into an agreement. And they're saying if you want to go to tax court, you can go ahead and file a tax court. And if not, after 90 days, we're going to start coming after and turn you over to collections. All right. Well, in this little subtle turnaround and switch that they pulled on us here, now you've got to petition the tax court. Okay. Before, you could petition your common law court. Now it's a tax court. If you petition a court and you're the moving party there, you've got the burden of proof. Now you've got to go into their tax court under their rules and their administrative judge, and you've got the burden of proof to prove whatever you're trying to assert there. And very, very few people come out of tax court with any success. I watched a tax court proceeding with my dear, now deceased friend in Atlanta, has the same name of a guy that's moves in circles in our community named David Strait. It's not the same as a different David Strait. And David was a self-made multimillionaire, and he had crossed swords with the IRS because he was writing a lot of articles, and he was a very, very active patriot, and he had money. So they came after him, and they basically told him that they were going to not allow the tax program that he'd been using for two previous companies, one of them called Lincoln Log Homes, which some of you are familiar with, that he was an owner of at one time. And they said, well, we'd blessed it, but we're not going to bless it anymore. You owe us $750,000, something to that effect. David decided to fight him. He took it to the tax court, which is in a historic old building in downtown Atlanta. It's the old post office. It's now the 11th Circuit, and it's a majestic building, all right? And I was so that's where the tax court was held, and we went up there. He had a very, very good lawyer. This lawyer, I think his name was Mims, who's out of Houston. He's a guy that got a $10 million judgment against the IRS 20-something years ago. David hired him, very, very sharp guy, and he was handling. He got the group leader on the stand there in tax court and got her to admit under oath that she had changed the figures and lied, okay, in tax court. In open court, right at the end of the day, the judge went apoplectic, called everybody in camera into his chambers, and read them the riot act. And the next morning when they reconvened, she got up there. It didn't ever punitively give her any punishment for lying under oath and lying under stand or changing the figures on the proceeds. They found David guilty, and fortunately for him, he had the money, and he stroked him out a check for couple of, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, all right? But that's about the success that you can get in tax court, even when you catch somebody in the hierarchy of the IRS lying under oath on the stand, all right? So I don't think you're going to see too much justice in there. That's your potential remedy that they give you, and we're going to cover the rest of it as we're into the break season on the other side, and we'll talk about our system. Thank you.
American Freedom News is your daily website that will keep you fully informed on what both the good guys and bad guys are doing in the information war in which we are all engaged. Fed up with the lies of the fake news media and the censorship of big tech giants? American Freedom News is the solution, as we provide truth and knowledge on all the vital issues of the day. American Freedom News believes in America first. The establishment wants us split into numerous hostile groups rather than uniting in a common cause against the corrupt oligarchy that is plundering America and the world. Many more Americans are waking up and realizing they are the victims of the ongoing Great Replacement and Great Reset. But the malevolent forces trying to systematically destroy America can and will be defeated. Be fully informed by reading American Freedom News, the best news and information site on the internet. Go to AmericanFreedomNews.us and find out for yourself. That's AmericanFreedomNews.us.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.